If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters. And what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Millie Cawthorne, and for today's podcast, I spoke to the cultural historian Karen Harvey about one of history's most bizarre hoaxes. In 1726, a poor working woman from Surrey caused a media sensation when she appeared to give birth to rabbits. Karen is the author of a new book on the case, The Impostress Rabbit Breeder, Mary Toft and 18th Century England. So I headed to Yorkshire to hear more from Karen about what this so-called rabbit breeder hoax can tell us about gender, class, society and scandal in the 18th century. So your new book delves into the story of the impostress rabbit breeder, Mary Toft, which was a case that captured the imagination of 18th century society. To start us off, can you just set the scene and outline what this bizarre hoax involved?
Well, I suppose the place to start is a woman who is poor. She is struggling to make ends meet. And she's in a small town in Surrey, Godalming, where there is a tremendous amount of unrest and social tension. So the hoax really happens in that context. What really happens is one of the great conundrums. So Mary Toft claimed to have given birth to rabbits. And several people supported this claim for a few weeks. It turns out, of course, that she didn't quite give birth to rabbits because, and this is the spoiler alert, women can't gestate rabbits, of course, but she didn't actually gestate and give birth to rabbits. The trigger for the whole affair, according to Mary Toft, was her working as an agricultural day labourer in a field on the outskirts of Godalming, seeing a couple of rabbits and deciding that she wanted to catch one of them. So she chased the rabbit, failed to catch it, and then the idea of that rabbit just wouldn't leave her head. She couldn't stop thinking about it, she said. She was already pregnant at this time, and a short while after seeing the rabbit, she reports experiencing what was clearly a miscarriage. The miscarriage went on for some weeks, and when that was concluded, she then started to pass these strange animal parts.
And what do we know was really happening?
Ah, what was really happening? Well, when the hoax is revealed, what's clearly been happening is that someone or several people have been providing Toft and her family with animals, with rabbits. Several witnesses say that they've been asked by the Toft family to give them rabbits. One reports that he provided them with live rabbits. And it's clear that those animals are killed, skinned, and dissected. And then they're used in the hoax. So that's what's really happening. But that doesn't... That isn't revealed until somebody in London who's been working at the establishment where Mary Toft has been kept by the doctors, that somebody confesses actually that he's been asked to provide rabbits. And it's at that point in early December that the hoax just falls apart.
I think a lot of people will have just heard that and gone, I'm sorry, what? Because on the face of it, this seems like an incredibly exceptional, bizarre case. But in your book, you're arguing that we can look at a strange case like this and it will tell us something about everyday life in 18th century society. How so?
Well, I think there are many threads that we can pull that can tell us a great deal about early 18th century society. The reason that I undertook this study in the first place was to train the light on Mary Toft herself. So I was really interested in the woman at the heart of the case. So historians have known about this case for quite a long time, and some fantastic work has been done on the case. But I felt reading that work that actually, though they'd thought about the case from the perspective of the doctors, they'd thought about the case from the perspective of the sort of public sphere, thinking about some of the satires that were produced around the case, what they hadn't really done was explore why a woman would become involved in something like this and what were the social and cultural conditions that made that possible. If you do that, I think you start to unpick some of the social, political, cultural conditions of the early 18th century. Things about social exclusion, about social unrest, around political tension, and also specifically around the position of women in early 18th century society.
I want to pick up your point there about social tensions and political unrest, because you suggest that we can't understand Mary Toft's hoax unless we understand the troubled community of Godalming that she came from. What was happening in the town at that time?
So Godalming in 1726 is a divided town. It's divided in a number of ways. There's a growing number of increasingly impoverished poor in Godalming. And there is a growing and it looks like increasingly affluent middling sort. And there are also some landed elite who have a great deal of power in the town as well. The middling sort are governing the town very strictly through a number of devices. And the poor are entirely excluded from those forms of governance and from the wealth in the town. Godalming had been a relatively affluent place because of the buoyant clothing trade, in which many of the poor were employed. But that trade is in decline. And that's really significant to understanding the case, actually, because Mary Toft's husband, Joshua, was an unskilled cloth worker. So he's sort of the lowest of the low, really, in this trade. And he will have been suffering because of the decline in the clothing trade. Put that together with Mary's economic position and ability to earn Mary, like many wives at this time, is engaged in paid employment in the market. She's actually an agricultural day labourer. And her wages, as far as we know, from her own, the amounts that she gives, her wages are incredibly low. So this is a very poor family.
Something that I think people might be surprised to learn as well is the fact that in this context, the rabbit is not a neutral animal to be at the centre of this case. They had political connotations. Can you explain how?
Yeah. Well, rabbits had long been a symbol of the wealthy, both because of the way that the fur was used to clothe the elite, but also the meat. Rabbits were the property of landowners. And it was only relatively recently that, you know, non-elite landowners had actually started commercially producing rabbits for a much wider market. Although that was still possible, many rabbits were still the property of the elite. Taking those rabbits was tantamount to theft, and that was a very serious crime and was becoming increasingly harshly punished at this time. The reason rabbits were often a source of tension in towns and environments like Godalming is because those landowners' rabbits would often escape their warrens. It's really hard to keep rabbits in one place. You can build walls, you can build fences, but they will jump or eat their way out. And so what happens is those rabbits escape. They escape onto common land. They eat the food that the commoners' animals might be grazing or that the commoners might be harvesting themselves for their own use or to then sell on market. So rabbits are a bit of a pest if you don't own them. Therefore, there'd been a number of protests across England focusing on rabbits and on the way that they symbolised really landowners' rights and, you know, conversely, the complete lack of rights of certain members of the agricultural or the rural poor.
Was that something that people connected to the Mary Toft case at the time?
So that's a really good question. Unfortunately, I haven't found a single clear and explicit reading of the case in that way. But there's lots of circumstantial evidence that to me adds up to something that's significant, actually. A number of protests are taking place precisely in and around Godalming at this time. There are protests around all kinds of animals, deer, fish, and all of those animals become in their own way symbols of elite privilege. And the poor or those who are excluded from established forms of governance and power holding use those animals as a focus for their grievances. This is a really important general context for the case, but it's actually very important specifically for Mary Toft's family, because one of the things I discovered in researching the book is that Joshua Toft, Mary's husband, was involved in such a protest. In fact, in the summer that the rabbit hoax is taking shape, Joshua Toft engages in a mass trespass on a fish pond in Godalming, and he appears at the Guildford Quarter Sessions to answer for that infraction, for that misdemeanour. So that's this really significant historical detail here, because whilst Joshua Toft is engaged in a clearly political protest with around 30 other men, his wife appears to be hatching a hoax, which also involves an animal which has been the focus of political dispute. I think we can quite reasonably, I think, connect those two. And I think contemporaries did.
As you mentioned earlier on, you put Mary Toft, the woman, back in the centre of the story. Mm. And there are not that many sources, I imagine, that tell us about ordinary working, labouring women's lives at this time. What does this case reveal about women's experiences and women's relationships?
Mm. To understand Mary Toft's life, it is very difficult. We have very few documents at our disposal, but there are a few scattered descriptions that appear in the newspapers and also in the printed books, which purport to be descriptions given by her. They've been, of course, mediated by the men who then produced those printed sources. But there's something else that we have, and we have three confessions or statements that were given by her, taken down actually by a doctor, James Douglas, and in the context of the criminal proceedings against Mary Toss. So these are legal documents, but they're the closest thing we get to an account of the hoax itself, the events leading up to it, and I think really interestingly, the social context in which those events happen. And I think they're really rich documents for unpicking a poor woman's life in the early 18th century. So we can learn all kinds of things. Mary Toff tells us the work that she's involved in. She tells us who she's been accompanied with while she's working. She tells us the route she takes home while she's working in the field. She tells us the women who come to the house when the first animal parts start to appear. She then tells us the steps that she and her mother-in-law go through in the early stages of the hoax, bringing in an array of men to investigate the case. So we learn a great deal about her life. I think the most striking thing for me that emerged from those statements of Mary Toft is the way that she's accompanied by women at almost every step. She's working alongside women in groups in the field. That's very common for women at this time. Women would work in teams as agricultural day laborers. She's also surrounded by women as these strange deliveries start to appear. And again, that's entirely typical. Childbirth was still, at this time, a female-dominated process. Women in childbed would be surrounded by other women, mainly and particularly by women who were very experienced in childbirth. So all of these things are entirely typical, even though at the heart of it is this extraordinary case of giving birth to rabbits, which was wholly atypical and indeed unique. Many of the details, the incidental details that she gives us are entirely convincing and reinforce for me the fact that a lot of what she's telling James Douglas and her interrogators is actually truthful.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And so gender gives a really particular spin to those social tensions. So I think that's probably, for me, at the heart of the case. And it's those social relations that are so wonderfully exposed by this really extraordinary affair.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match. With Indeed, use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Do we get any sense of the motivation behind the hoax from those confessions?
Why the hoax happened is one of those questions that's, again, very difficult to answer. A really easy answer might be they did it for money. That's an explanation that several historians have entertained. The problem with that explanation is that no money appears to ever have changed hands, and there are only one or two references to money. Mary Toft was allegedly offered a pension by the king and other bits of money from a couple of the doctors, although they were sort of dangled in front of her, it looks like, and she didn't actually receive any money. If that was the ambition of Mary Toft and the people around her, then the hoax was a complete failure because, as I say, she didn't earn anything. I'm not wholly convinced by that, because if I think they were after money, they'd have set up the hoax a little bit differently and they'd have started charging people for seeing, for coming to witness this affair. I think why it happened is a difficult question to answer, but I think there are a couple of factors that we need to bear in mind. I think, first of all, that political context is terrifically important. And in the book, I talk about that as one explanation. The way that Mary Toft describes her chasing the rabbit because she's poor and can't afford them suggests to me that she's entirely conscious of the political punch that the hoax is going to have. So I think that's one important possible explanation, and I think a likely one. I think the other one is something a bit murkier and a bit darker, and that's about the women. So whether Mary Toft designed the hoax herself, I think, is a moot point. In the book, I make an alternative case, and the case is that actually she was persuaded, encouraged, perhaps even forced to go through with this rather difficult series of events by the women around her. The women are surrounding Mary Toft right from the start, and in her statements, she explains very clearly that they are the driving force, that she is intimidated by them, and she's intimidated in particular by her mother-in-law. And actually, in the final statement, when she's asked straight, "Who put you up to this?" Mary Toft gives a really unequivocal answer. She said it was her mother-in-law. And I think it's there that we need to look for the motivation. Mary Toft is a very young wife and mother of a toddler, James. She looks as if she's living with her husband's family. She's had one child who has sadly already passed away. She has an awful miscarriage as the hoax starts to develop. And I think there's something about her failing in her sort of reproductive duty for contemporaries that might be at the heart of this affair for the women around her. Whatever the motivation, I think the real driving force for it comes not from Mary herself, but from her mother-in-law and from the other older authoritative women that are around her at the time. My take on the case is that she has really barely any agency over what's happening to her. Part of that reading is very much thinking about the reality and the materiality, the physical nature of the hoax. Without going into too much detail, Mary Toft does have animal parts inside her body, and those animal parts have to come out of her body. And that goes on for several weeks. This is a really painful, uncomfortable, and very risky affair. It's difficult to know for sure from the historical records, but I find it very hard to believe that a woman would do that willingly, all by herself. Practically, it's extremely hard to do that all by yourself. And a lot of the evidence that we do have is clear that Mary Toft is frightened, that she feels pressured at every turn. The driving force, I think, as we've discussed around this case, is not Mary Toft herself. So
there was a lot of biological evidence that suggested this was a hoax. It wasn't that the doctors involved were entirely ignorant. Why do you think that they were so willing to overlook these signs and really wanted to invest in the idea that it could be true?
Well, I think that's really important. So, but I would turn that around a bit. It's not quite that the doctors were invested in the fact that it could be true. I think the doctors are really invested in cutting-edge scientific method. You know, their reputation stands and falls on the way in which they investigate the case. These aren't quacks. These are, you know, very highly regarded, very highly qualified doctors. They come from different places, different countries, but a very high proportion of them have a direct link to the royal household of King George I. So these are, as I say, very, very reputable medical men. I think even though the theory of the maternal imagination, the idea that women who are pregnant can see something or feel something, and then their emotional response to that can actually imprint physically on the unborn child. Even though that theory still has credence in some medical quarters, I don't think the doctors are actually wedded to that idea. But I think what's going on is that they don't want to discount this apparent hoax until they can prove it and prove it beyond doubt. So the argument I make in the book is not that the doctors are credulous and that they believe until the very last minute. I think actually in most cases it's probably more like the reverse. I think actually they probably don't believe, but they feel they can't make that argument until they've actually gone through a series of steps. So yes, they take various animal parts, they conduct experiments on them. There's only one doctor, I think, who believes that this really could be a hoax. I think the others are conducting experiments. They are sharing the information. They are asking their colleagues, their peers, for their views. And it's only once the kind of mass of evidence has been brought together and a consensus has been reached, that they will start to actually say, look, we have used our scientific method. We have proved now that this actually is not a live, monstrous birth happening in London in front of our eyes. This actually is a hoax, and it was a hoax from the beginning.
See, that's interesting, because I think that has essentially turned what I was going to ask you next on its head, because I was going to say, we think of the 18th century as the time of the Enlightenment, but that suggests those ideas maybe weren't that secure. Whereas what you're saying is, really, the emphasis was on being open-minded and testing everything scientifically.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to suggest that monstrous births were ruled out of hand. That's certainly not the case. There is a live debate about that. And many respected intellectuals and also sort of amongst sort of the lay, the sort of non-expert population, people still do believe that what women think when they're pregnant will have an impact on the unborn. The question is, what's the impact? Exactly what is the impact? So, you know, they understand, or they believe that women can think of a peach And, you know, a child could be born with a reddened birthmark, for example. But it's quite different from saying women can chase a rabbit, not get the rabbit. And the idea of that kind of lost rabbit can turn the fetus into a rabbit. But those two are on a similar continuum. So there's a really live debate about this. So what we're seeing here absolutely is the Enlightenment. And that is an open-minded, as you say, debate often conducted in public about the natural world, what we know about the natural world and how we find out about the natural world.
As you say, that debate was often conducted in public and there was an immense media sensation around Mary Toft. Yeah. Why do you think there was such a public clamour and what does it tell us about the emergence of celebrity culture at the time?
Was Mary Toft a celebrity? Well, she was a celebrity of a kind. But actually, her celebrity as it develops is really the focus for some really unsavoury, prurient and rather nasty press. Initially, the clamour around the case actually isn't really about Mary Toft at all. It's really about the rabbits and it's about this apparently miraculous and extraordinary physical thing that's happened. As it turns out, that the case, you know, is exposed as a hoax, she becomes actually a figure of hate for most people who write about her. She was the poor woman, and now she becomes described as wicked. What does it tell us about celebrity? I mean, it tells us that there's a tremendous curiosity for the extraordinary. As you say, there are large groups of people who visit her in Guildford, in London, and then remarkably who go and visit her when she's in prison in the Westminster House of Correction. So it tells us that people are hungry for those kinds of stories, those sort of remarkable stories. But as I say, there's a really unpleasant tenor to some of that interest. I think as a woman, you know, she's the victim of blatant misogyny. There are some dreadful discussions around the case, around her body. I think the fact that she's poor is also tremendously significant. She's seen as a threat, both to the sort of general elite, to those reputable doctors who, you know, she appears to have made a mockery of, and also to the royal household and perhaps the king himself. It's widely known that the king had quite an interest in the case. So when the case is exposed as a hoax, the potential embarrassment for the king is clearly there.
So do you think that's why there was such a strong reaction against Mary Toft? Because ultimately no one was harmed here, no money changed hands, nobody was hurt, but there was a massive appetite to see her punished.
You know, a poor individual, and particularly a poor woman, you know, didn't have in this society many resources at their disposal to engage in politics and in public debate. This is one reading of this case, is that this is actually a really eloquent political protest on the part of a poor woman. And I think there is evidence for that case. But, you know, there's also something, you know, just much more prurient going on here. This is a case that allows for all kinds of innuendo at the expense of Mary Toft herself, but also at the doctors. You know, it's a potential, you know, it gives great comedic material to all of those early 18th century satirists and humorists whose living is made by, you know, making smutty jokes. And, you know, the early 18th century public lap those up. So, you know, it's potentially hilarious, but it also, as I say, allows that sort of misogynist strand to come out.
Yeah, I think we often think of the Georgian era as very elegant and refined, but this suggests that there was a very bawdy, seedier undercurrent to it all.
Yeah, and I think for me, there's almost two sides of the same coin, actually. You know, the people who are, you know, going to those new public spaces of refinement, who are, you know, dressing elegantly, who are engaging in polite conversation, they're the very same people who are curious about Mary Taft, who are exchanging jokes and stories about her. We see this in the newspapers. We see this in the very few number of letters that survive that talk about her. We see this in the published pamphlets. You know, so the public sphere, the 18th century public sphere, is very diverse. Yes, there is, you know, polite gentility, but there's also bawdy smut and bawdy humour.
Perhaps it's worth mentioning where all of this left Mary Taft. How did she come out the other side of the case?
That's a really interesting question. It's very difficult to trace what happens to Mary Taft after the case has sort of fallen apart. So she's released from the House of Correction. She will have been and is reported to have been very poorly and considerably weakened by the whole experience. But she goes on to have another child within a year, remarkably. We don't know if she had any more children. The historical record doesn't tell us. And so she sort of falls back into a certain amount of obscurity. She appears again in the historical record just a couple more times. She is accused of shoplifting around 15 years after the case. And then finally, the record of her burial, which one would expect to be a relatively innocuous parish book entry, as they normally are, reminds us of the case. And so in the parish register, she's recorded as having been buried, and she's named as Mary Toft, the imposterous rabbit breeder. And I think that's a remarkable entry in the parish register. You know, on a page where everybody else is just referred to by their name, she's given this title. And so it's quite clear that in Godalming, 40 years after the case, there is a very live memory of her participation in this hoax. So clearly in Godalming, this reputation will have followed her about. Quite what an impact that had on her life, it's just very difficult for us to say, because we don't have any really detailed qualitative material from her or from anyone around her once the hoax has concluded.
So if we look at 18th century England through the lens of this case, what kind of society is revealed?
I think the picture that I take away from this case of early 18th century British society is one of social inequity and social conflict. And that's partly spinning on social rank. So it's partly about the poor, the impoverished, the middling sort, and the elite, and the tensions between those groups. But it's also about gender. And gender gives this case a really particular spin, I think, because you throw into that world of social inequity and social tension, you throw into that world another set of inequities and hierarchies, and those are ones about men and women. We see them played out between those elite men who represent the criminal justice system and Mary Taft, the poor woman. We see them played out between those privileged doctors and Mary Tough, the poor woman. And so gender gives a really particular spin to those social tensions. So I think that's probably, for me, at the heart of the case. It's those forces, those social relations that are driving the case. And it's those social relations that are so wonderfully exposed by this really extraordinary affair.
That was Karen Harvey. Her book, The Impostorous Rabbit Breeder, Mary Toft in 18th Century England, is available now, published by Oxford University Press. You can also read a version of my interview with Karen in the February issue of BBC History magazine. That's on sale now and also includes features on the Spanish Armada, the liberation of Auschwitz, and the Little Ice Age. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in next on Monday, when Mary Beard will be discussing the nude in antiquity.